It is the U.S. Turkey Day version of the Broken Clock Podcast, or episode of the Broken Clock Podcast. And I say Turkey Day this time around because a lot of people are acting like turkeys this year. It is the height of the second wave of COVID-19 pandemic, and yet millions of Americans are traveling to see their families. Now, my thesis, and Mouse, you can tell me if you agree on this or not, but I don't think that people are traveling because they don't think COVID is serious. Some, yes, but I would bet that the majority know it's a risk, but believe that pissing off their mother is a bigger risk, and guilt is driving these decisions. And that's the topic for today's podcast. Guilt and peer pressure, in this case, family pressure, doing things you know aren't smart. Now, Mouse, I have to admit I have a bit of a confession to make about this. I am guilty of this myself. My mother periodically gets on me. I've only seen my mother in person once during this whole COVID-19 thing. Even then, it was sort of okay, sort of not okay, but she's pushing again to get together again. And her birthday's coming up right before Christmas, and I'm really having trouble saying no. And I'm pushing it along, but I'm pretty sure at some point I'm gonna cave and not compromise, just cave, just do exactly what she wants because she's my mother. And I don't know of anybody who finds it easy to say no to their mother. And so this is where I find myself. I know it's not the smart thing to do. I'm just not sure I can let critical thinking overwhelm the guilt, because my mother is an expert at guilt. So have you found yourself in similar situations where you know you're doing something dumb, but you're doing it because you feel guilty?
Remember, I grew up Catholic.
Well, I thought I wouldn't assume. However, you know, Hispanic Catholic families. Yeah, I don't know if they're worse than Jewish families, but
I think they're Hispanic Catholic families have managed to wield two very, very powerful weapons. Oh. One of them is guilt, and the other one is la chancla.
Okay, what is the latter?
It's the slipper.
Right. My late grandmother, she had deadly aim with the slipper.
Yep. So there's for those readers who may readers, we're in a newspaper. you can tell I haven't had my first cup of coffee. For the listeners out there, there is a YouTube network channel called Pero Like, mm-hmm. That is aimed at Hispanics, and it's run by Hispanics, but it makes fun of a whole bunch of common cultural things, and la chancla is one of those things. Mm-hmm. And they have hilarious skits about it. So if you want to know more about what that is, just go to the YouTube channel and type chancla, chancla, and you'll see what I mean.
What is it about booby figures? Like boobies, abuelitas, you know, nanas, they have deadly aim with slippers. Like, it's not like they practice, right? It's just like they suddenly develop the force that is specific to slippers, right? Like all of a sudden they become Jedi masters with the aim. They just trust their feelings and just bean ya every single time. It's pretty incredible.
I know, I've seen it. I've seen the accuracy of it across a crowded room, and it was
It like zigzags around people to hit its intended target.
I think we've just discovered the next Assassin's Creed, what the next Assassin's Creed game should be.
Well, they did have the hacker granny in Watch Dogs Legion, so why not like a magic bullet force slipper granny in it? What would be Assassin's Creed? what would they do it in South Central America?
Central America.
Assassin's Creed Central America, where an abuelita is an assassin.
My nanny's creed.
My nanny's creed. But it's interesting because I did some research on guilt. And here's the problem with guilt and how it is going to override your critical thinking. No, seriously, it will. It doesn't matter how iron a will you have, it will. Guilt actually has a social function in that it preserves our relationships. So if you are a pro-social person, you apparently on average experience 5 hours of guilty feelings a week. That's a lot. That really surprised me, but that is according to Psychology Today. And we know that guilt makes it difficult to think straight. Apparently concentration, productivity, creativity, and efficiency are all sufficiently lower when you're feeling guilty. So it's one of those things that guilt also makes you self-punish. One person called it the Dobby effect after the Harry Potter books, but it breeds resentment. So there is no way to override a process that happens faster than cognitive thought. With cognitive thought, all we can really do is process it. And I guess it's almost a harm reduction strategy, isn't it? Right? Like, you're going to do something dumb. You just have to minimize the dumb.
That's true. And it's a little bit weird for me because on the whole, I am not someone who gets rattled by guilt unless I know I have done something bad or that I have hurt someone I care about. And that's me now, of course, now. But growing up, like I said, in a Hispanic Catholic country, very, very, very Catholic, mm-hmm. That was not the case at all. Guilt used to be, and it's true, it used to be a pretty frequent thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's a dynamic in so many. It's an immigrant family thing, I think. I find it's more prevalent in families of immigrants, and it doesn't matter the culture, right? It's the, I guess, when you separate from, you know, your place of origin, the bonds you have with people physically become more meaningful, and there's more invested in protecting those relationships. But, you know, Toronto has a ton of immigrant populations, and this is something that's, you know, common across all of them. Hence my big fat Greek wedding taking on so much in cities, right? It being the surprise hit because it was just sort of this universal thing.
Yeah. I mean, it was portrayed as a Greek, as something very much, Greek culture.
But it was related, Jewish culture. It was Italian culture. I know, like, Indian, Pakistani, Sri Lankan families, you know, Tamils, Sinhalese, and the Sri Lankan, they all deal with this.
Yes. But
it's the moms. Okay. My husband gets guilted by his dad too. I will admit that. But it's mostly the moms that are experts in guilt. I'm not sure why. I just know this is so.
That is true. And well, I think the reason for that is that in a lot of these communities, the mother, you know, even in a lot of cultures in America, as in from America, so you have very different cultural dynamics, say in the South, mm-hmm, and within subcultures in the South and etc. But in a lot of those, the mother is kind of the social center. Mm-hmm. You often hear that what happens when the mother in the house dies, it's like the family falls apart, the unity disappears, because the mother is the kind of the glue that holds it all together. And, you know, and especially in cultures where women don't have a lot of power and are not regarded as having opinions you know, at times that are co-equal with with men. Sometimes the most effective way to get people to listen is through, you know, the dynamics of guilt.
And it's not healthy, right?
No.
It's ultimately something that you do have to overcome or it will hold you back. But there's no way to eliminate it completely.
Right. Like, oh, we are breaking the streak that we broke. I have a quote from Ayn Rand.
So hey, after 2 weeks, Ayn Rand returns.
Yes, she did say guilt is a rope that wears thin.
And I mean, in the context of Ayn Rand's life, that's very poignant because for people that don't know very, very much about, you know, the biography of Ayn Rand, it was the Russian government, right, or the Soviet government at the time that basically coerced her own sister to denounce her. Right.
Yeah. So she, for decades, she desperately tried to get her parents out, but she was never able to. After she left, and very soon after she left, things closed down furiously after the war. And so she tried for decades. And of course, it was hard to do because she was, by the point she had enough influence to try to do something, she was an internationally known novelist with opinions that were pretty much denounced in Russia. And so she was trying to get these people, to get her parents out, while also not trying not to draw attention to her family, because she was afraid they would target her. That's why she wrote under that pseudonym, Ayn Rand. Her name was Elizabeth? Her last name was Rosenbaum.
Yeah.
Eliza Rosenbaum.
Yeah.
Jewish Russian.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, her parents died. And she finally was able to contact her sister the end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s. And she brought her over to New York to visit her. And she was looking so she was really looking forward to seeing her, because when they were children, they kind of had the same dreams. Ayn Rand wanted to be a movie actress or a movie director, movie writer. She wanted to write screenplays, which she did. She wrote one called The Red Pond that was actually turned into a movie in the Cecil B. DeMille hearing. And Nora, her sister, wanted to be a fashion model, etc. But it was pretty sad. When Nora arrived in New York, she had become a complete, total communist, brainwashed completely. And it was a very, very bitter experience for Ayn Rand, because Nora loathed her just on principle. Without really, just on principle.
And I think that's actually quite relevant to today, because a lot of families right now are dealing with the double stress of, you know, making a series of harm reduction decisions with COVID-19, but also dealing with intense political polarization that is dividing families, friend circles. And I mean, yeah, politics have been fraught in the past, but in our lifetimes, we have not seen anything like this, even in the anti-war movements, even with the upheavals in the 60s and 70s, people were just better at talking to each other back then. We've lost the skill of, and it is a learned skill, of being assertive, right? I've noticed a gradual slipping of direct confrontation And that's an assimilation thing. I mean, when I was in university taking anthropology, we actually studied the different social customs of various groups. And part of the reason that immigrant groups in, I'd say, you know, Western European cultures, but for lack of a better term, I'll say white cultures, meaning that specific kind of shared things about, you know, Britain and the US and Canada, where, you know, respectable white people, there's some things you just don't say, and you communicate your displeasure through indirection or silence, if that makes any sense. And it becomes this series of, I mean, nonverbal cues has become kind of an eye rolling meme at this point, but it's true. It seems like the more dominant a culture gets, the more direct confrontation, except when people get drunk at family events, direct confrontation becomes this thing to avoid at all costs, which is why it blows up when, you know, everybody gets together and there's alcohol involved. I think some people are falsely idealizing their family get-togethers this year because it's not a guarantee. Every other year, it's how do I deal with my difficult family advice pieces. This year, it's how not to go. Right. The spin on its axis is notable. And so every other year, people treated like seeing their family was, I mean, in some cases it is blinking awful. And in those cases, I'm a big believer in just don't go. Like, don't. If it makes you that miserable, don't go. This year, I have not seen one thing about dealing with being estranged from your family at the holidays. It's the opposite. How to talk to your family about you're not coming because of COVID. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's one strategy that I use to overcome the way guilt is the mind killer, right? That I tell myself that relationships are two-way streets. And if other people are not making allowances for you, you don't have to make allowances for other people. Because I didn't believe this until the last 5 or so years. You train people how to treat you. If you are just always the person that caves and always does what everybody wants every single time, you are that person forever. And it's not a failing so much as it's people taking your good nature and using it against you. You have no moral obligation to people who do that to you. That's an important thing to remember, right? And I think some people are so, it's not guilt so much as it is fear. They're so afraid of being alone that they'll put up with bad behavior. Guilt functions differently. Guilt is this sense of unfulfilled obligation that nags at you, you know? And I think the reason that mothers are so good at guilt is, I mean, let's face it, most people were raised by their mothers. Mothers get a lot of credit. I won't say they owe their mothers. I think that's not a good way to think about it. That's a negative way of thinking about it. But, you know, most people are rightly grateful to the guidance and support and, you know, the start in life that their mothers gave them. So they want to pay that back in their own way. That's why I'm surprised that these campaigns didn't target older people. And this is one of the things I find curious about the COVID strategies is, let's face it, if COVID ends up in a family gathering, it is the older people in the equation who are at greatest risk, right? And this is the thing I'm kind of struggling with my own mother. she does have the right to make decisions regarding her own health and her own life. And this is one of the ways am I doing this for a good reason? Like, is that guilt, that positive way of preserving the relationship? Or, you know, at a certain point, you can't save people from themselves. You know what I'm saying? And so if an older person really wants to take that risk, there's something there, right? They have the right mm-hmm. to do what they want with their own life. Now, that being said, I'm also in a risk group and my mother happens to live in a, they're not in lockdown, in fairness. So they still allow gatherings of under 10 people, mm-hmm. but still. And that's the thing. Like if she was in a lockdown zone, it would be absolutely no, like rules are rules, which I recognize is a cop out, right? Rules are rules. That's a shorthand. Just because a rule exists doesn't mean a rule is just, and doesn't necessarily mean right. you obey every rule, as long as you're prepared to accept the consequence of not obeying the rule. But in lockdown cases, they're reasonable rules, right? And this is where I start going, I know I'm being stupid, but I'm doing it to not rock the boat, because I could get into the whole negotiation process of, well, maybe you should come up here, but she came up here the last time. So that's that social reciprocity thing, right? And then it's, well, maybe we should just get takeout and like eat at home. She wants to support a local business. It was the place she went to with my late stepfather every Friday night. And so there's that emotional attachment of kind of honoring his memory by continuing to go there on Friday nights. So there's that extra emotional charge. And I recognize that my immediate gut reaction of this is causing me more guaranteed harm than taking a moderate risk regarding COVID will. And I'm not sure that's entirely logical, but it is certainly meaningful, right? One way or another, I'm going to end up miserable. And that's the problem with guilt, right? Most personal critical thinking is about what's going to make me least miserable. This is more of a choice of what type of misery do I want to risk most, you know? And those are very difficult, rational decision processes.
It's very hard because not just your emotions, but because of the emotional connection, your brain kind of sees that the potential emotional upset as a lasting lasting damage.
Well, and then you read all the guilt pieces about the mental health epidemic that's going on with COVID, and of course they're finding more and more. No, that's not necessarily true. There has been an uptick, but there hasn't been a surge commensurate with the surge in COVID-19 cases in terms of mental health, right? But that's where you get into, I'm starting to understand anti-vaccine parents in terms of guilt. Hear me out. I'm not saying you shouldn't vaccinate your kids. I'm just saying that, well, what if, right? Trying to stave off future guilt. It's very powerful. You know? Because you are aware of a tiny, minuscule, unlikely risk, you self-punish like crazy if, you know, luck isn't with you that time and the worst case scenario happens, which is, again, not rational. And I guess the goal there is to work on the self-punishment so it's not so agonizing a decision-making process. And this is where we get into making mistakes is really hard, especially when mistakes harm another person. And again, with this particular situation, you're having to choose between harms to another person. It really is a interpersonal Kobayashi Maru And for people who don't know, Kobayashi Maru is a Star Trek test where it's supposed to be teaching somebody how to fail. Good leaders know how to fail with dignity. Donald Trump needed a Kobayashi Maru test, but in Star Trek canon, Kirk cheated on the Kobayashi Maru, and therefore people say beat it, but the truth is he just negated the purpose of the test. And so when something did happen where he couldn't win, it resulted in the death of his son. He had really intense trouble coping because he never learned how to fail efficiently. And that is what is so strange. And that is what I think is causing so many errors in not just critical thinking and morality. I think an ongoing theme of this podcast is that the two things are tied, right? Critical thinking and morality is that people are bubble wrapped away from failure in their formative years. The requirements on teens and young adults are so ridiculous. You know, if you don't get 95% on everything, you're not going to get into college. You're not going to get into a good college, which means you're going to be poor your whole life. That's ridiculous, right? That doesn't teach students how to fail. That teaches students how to avoid failure. And so you get into adulthood and you suck at mistakes. You suck at recovering from failure. And it is a shitty process to learn. And okay, to be clear, nobody likes making a mistake. I want to be abundantly clear. Mistakes aren't fun. But you take somebody like, there are examples, they're eluding me right now of people. Oh, Justin Trudeau was a shining example. He got caught doing blackface, okay? And he nailed the apology so well. He stuck the landing so well, enough people were willing to forgive him that he, you know, squeaked out minority reelection. That's a guy who, well, he knows how to take a punch, literally. He's a boxer. But he knows how to handle royally screwing up. And apparently he learned that from his mother, Margaret, who was notoriously a quote unquote embarrassment to his father, Pierre's government, because she was mentally ill and did some very embarrassing things because, you know, she was symptomatic and people were not as understanding of that sort of stuff back then. So there's sort of a family legacy of being very, very, very good at screwing up, which I think he doesn't get enough credit for now because politics is a blood sport. But I think it's a very important lesson that we negate or we disregard at our own peril. Because I think the big difference between people who succeed and people who fail in life, like people who are overall successful in life, is the ability to recover from mistakes. And a lot of that is dealing with guilt.
If you compare, for example, Trudeau with ex-president Donald Trump.
Outgoing. He's still president.
Outgoing. Yeah, well, I'm living in January right now.
You're doing positive future visualization?
I'm doing positive future visualization because the circus he's performing right now is absolutely disgraceful. It is the most undignified display of any sitting United States president ever. And this includes the guy who used to take out his tonker in public.
Well, I think the fact that, you know, that word you used, undignified, I think the lack of dignity in Trump is precisely his appeal with his base, because his base, no matter how rich they are, revels in a lack of dignity. They're that group of people who, instead of taking steps to reclaim their dignity, their identity has become a hubris in a lack of dignity, if that makes any sense.
It's the it really is just the, it's self-debasement it's interesting because the entire base is the whole notion of, if we can't get what we want, sorry, well, I need to think about that thought. It's just starting to form, but it's along the lines.
Okay, go ahead.
It's along the lines of getting what you want is a lot more important than who you end up becoming when you get that. I have never quite understood the notion of someone who would throw who they are away, who would burn that down to get something, because when you get it, you're not the same person who wanted it anymore.
You're assuming that any of these people actually have a fully formed sense of self, that part. And getting back to guilt, I think that that's not, you know, we can't assume that half of, well, not half of America, because only 65% of the country voted, but mm-hmm. that, you know, 70.
But that was the highest turnout in 100 years.
I know. Don't get me started. But, you know, you've got 35% of the country who's just given up in terms of the franchise, right? Then you've got another whatever voted, you know, the 70 million people or 71 or whatever it is right now. I don't think they are bad people. I think they are guilt-ridden people, and they are running from that guilt so fast that they are tripping all over themselves. They have no concept of moral or critical reasoning anymore, because they are just running from guilt.
Maybe a percentage of them, but there's quite a few pieces of shit in that group.
Well, okay,
the ones that have fully embraced the things such as white supremacy and like militant nationalism.
I think the core of all of that is guilt. I do. I really do. They can't take the guilt of privilege anymore, and so they reject it.
Some of them, but the other, see, there is a subset of people that I have encountered that is the opposite. You see, there is a disquieting number of people who have heard about white privilege and who do not flinch from the idea. Rather, many are angry that they have not gotten to experience it, that they have not gotten to benefit from it, because in their mind, white privilege is the way that the world should be, the way in which the world should be ordered.
Okay, but again, you drill down on that one and you get the underbelly of guilt, because I've talked to people who believe in this, and they communicated without realizing it. Basically, if white privilege is real and I benefit from white privilege, well, my life sucks and I'm a complete screw up, making me double the screw up.
The screw up.
Right? Like, they cannot handle the guilt inherent of being, you know, a poster child for failed potential. Therefore, they just completely reject privilege theory. Now, of course, that's a lack of understanding of privilege theory, because there are, you know, economic and disability paradigms that still impact white men. But, you know, mental health, socioeconomic, access to education, all this stuff, white privilege is pretty reductive in a lot of ways. But
right. And just because you also have you have access to these things doesn't mean that no matter how much privilege you have, you can royally screw your life through bad decisions.
Yeah, but the consequences, and this is what people who reject privilege theory don't understand. You are insulated from the dire consequences of such a bad decision, unlike somebody with less social privilege, right?
Let's look at Donald.
Well, yeah, or his kids. right?
Mm-hmm.
Especially, well, Don Jr. is the, you know, going after Hunter Biden when his own son had substance problems back in the day. But as long as you don't call yourself an addict, oh God, you don't have that stigma, right?
Pretty much.
But I mean, you can't, and there's a shining example, you can't compare somebody like the Trumps who were born into money and have spent their entire life making a series of rather spectacular lateral moves. You know, adjusted for inflation, Donald Trump is no more rich today than he was the day he was born, right?
Mm-hmm.
That is different. Trump can fail in a business. He can, you know, publicly embarrass himself. He could make a complete fool of himself, and he still got a glorious golden parachute when he's out of office, right? Compare that to some schmo in Eastern Kentucky with an opioid addicted mother.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not going to have the same opportunities, and they are more likely to lose everything they built up because they do not have that intergenerational wealth. This is the stuff we should be discussing, because you've got one side of the culture war trying to stave off the potential guilt of, oh, gee, I actually do have a modicum of white privilege and my life still sucks, which means I'm a failure. No, it doesn't. That's the error in thinking. Guilt is often the byproduct of errors in thinking, by the by. But then you've got the other side of people who have been pushing this critical race theory ad nauseum. And we're just getting to the point where critical race theory is starting to show some signs of strain. Most notably that people who claim to be practitioners of critical race theory aren't actually following it completely, but it's starting to show signs of strain. It's starting to show that the sensitivity programs, the anti-racism programs based on critical race theory are not effective. And okay, these people just spent the last 10 years openly calling everybody who disagrees with them a racist. They've got a lot to potentially reckon for. So you've got two sides trying to outrun their guilt, which is why the division just gets worse and worse and worse. And we don't get workable solutions because people aren't interested first and foremost in finding solutions of getting the best outcomes. People first and foremost are trying to outrun their guilt.
I just had a flashback to. Well, it's I hold the theory that for every moral quandary and for every moral point, there is an applicable Stephen Sondheim musical.
We'll have to test that theory one of these days.
We'll have to test that theory, but you know, his musicals are so intelligent, and they're very seldom just eye candy. They're there to make a point. And no musical makes as many points as Into the Woods.
Yep.
I knew that was coming. It's the crown jewel of musicals, really, when you think about it. But you know, that undertone of guilt, that it's like I was listening and running away from guilt. That's the the baker and his father. You know, his father ran away from the guilt for so long, and it left this huge amount of trauma dropped in the lap of his son.
Well, let's face it, the entire purpose of fairy tales was to either guilt or scare illiterate small townspeople into social compliance. Like, that was the whole purpose of fairy tales.
Well, compliance, and also, you know, to teach children to fear certain things. Because, Little Red Riding Hood is basically a warning to girls about sexual predators.
Yep. Yep. Don't talk to strange wolves in the woods.
But, you know, it had to be told in a way that, you know, because you couldn't say, don't trust strange men.
With men in your shot. Yeah.
Yeah, with men in earshot in a society that where men had a pretty good amount of social power.
That's right. That's right.
So a lot of these fairy tales were code. And if anyone is interested in learning more about that, there's of course a wonderful book that was the inspiration that inspired Sondheim to create Into the Woods, and it's called The Uses of Enchantment.
Yep. Great book.
Great book.
I mean, that's the obviously the greatest source of guilt in the modern day is some form of religion. And even mm-hmm. that was a lot of coded language, because various religious documents were set down in diasporas, meaning the people who were writing them down, you know, the Torahs, the mm-hmm. classic example, but, you know, the Bible as well, in a lot of ways, that some of the things that the Bible was trying to speak out against with good reason was being done when you couldn't rock the boat too much in you know, Babylon or Greece or Rome, right? And so a lot of the things that people fight to the death about today, homosexuality, for instance, may very well have been a bunch of coded language prohibiting child abuse, notably mm-hmm. child abuse of 13-year-old boys. And this is the sort of context that gets lost. Because,
right, the Ars Nocotae translation.
Yeah, or even the what were they called? Kadashes,
mm-hmm.
that was translated to sodomites, but that actually isn't what the word meant. The word meant temple prostitutes,
mm-hmm.
which were often, you know, sometimes as young as 13. The minute one little chinny chin hair sprouted on that boy's chin, hey, there's grass in the field, play ball. It sounds disgusting because it is disgusting, but that was mm-hmm. a normalized practice back then. And I give Assassin's Creed Odyssey credit for depicting great Greek philosophers as catty, at minimum, bisexual dudes. Good for you, Ubisoft, injecting some hilarious, probably very accurate social commentary, modern social commentary into the ancient.
Aristophanes being the catty, it was basically just the catty theater geeks.
He was totally like, not even. He was like that main guy, Carson from Queer Eye from the Straight Guy.
So I have it. It was like watching a cat fight between Oscar Wilde and Noel Coward.
That was pretty much it. Him and Sophocles?
Sophocles.
Yeah. Yeah. It's Sophocles or Socrates?
Sophocles.
It was Sophocles. Okay. Wait, yeah.
Because the playwright. Yeah.
Yeah. The playwright. Yeah. It was the better looking gay guy and the smarter gay guy. Love hate relationship. which is interesting because they did the same thing with Cain and Lucifer in the Lucifer TV show. And that was hilarious. But because Lucifer definitely sits on the boundary of gay or British.
Was that a Good Omens reference?
No, but obviously, I mean, there's one day we will be in a place to be able to joke about the sheer amount of gay in the Bible. But we're not there yet. And therefore, the sheer amount of accidental gay in Lord of the Rings, which was totally unintentional, but so very much there. But I mean, all these things, this is, you know, we're being blasphemous here. We're being cheeky. And yet we're doing it to make a point, right? Because why don't most people joke about this sort of content? Guilt. And that's it. It doesn't make any sense beyond that, right? A good way to make sure you have perspective on something is to be able to joke about it. And I am amazed at how lost that awareness is in the urge for people, very smart people, to call attention to themselves by being offended. Right? They feel like being offended means anything, but you are burning unnecessary energy. I'm astounded by the complete removal of critical thinking that goes on nowadays with people doing tribal signaling. It's not even virtue signaling anymore. There is no professed virtue. It is we're all afraid of the exact same things. We're going back to that into the woods, fairy tale, frightened village people trope again. Academics now are acting like frightened village people. And I swear it's because with the decrease in the number of tenured positions, all of a sudden academics do not have the cushy job security that they thought they would have at that point in their career, right?
That's true. Someone is circumstances have rocked the ivory tower.
Yeah, it doesn't matter how much you publish now. Those tenured jobs are just not there.
And I've always had an issue with tenured jobs to begin with, because it kind of creates this license for the academic to, you know, put in a lot of rigorous intellectual work. But once tenure is achieved,
right,
they can just let their brain go to rot. And that really does explain how a lot of, you know, once potentially brilliant, respected academics who carved a path early in their career suddenly become these crazy old men. Like, for example, you got, well, not exactly the same thing, but Paul Krugman, everybody talks about how he won, you know, a Nobel Prize in economics. But mm-hmm. what everybody tells you, nobody tells you, is that he won a Nobel Prize in economics by espousing views that are completely different to what he currently espouses now. Well,
that's very true. That's very true. I mean, he's got a lot of Trump derangement syndrome.
Well, he has been deranged for many, many years. One of the things I don't like about Krugman is that he constantly readjusts his predictions, so yeah. He always looks like he has been right.
He does
the Nostradamus scholar thing, because, you know, people who are call themselves Nostradamus scholars and then they publish books about how Nostradamus's predictions and what the next prediction will be,
right?
They usually have, if you can find several editions, you'll go, oh well, so. And this one, James Randi did this, like, oh, rest in peace, James Randi. He did this guy who called himself a rogue Nostradamus scholar, and he said, well, I have several editions of the same book here, and see, if you look in this one, he claims that the Antichrist is going to be Khomeini, and, you know, that didn't work out because he died. So right. In the next one, oh, look, it's Saddam Hussein.
Yeah.
And then, oh, he fell down. So who's the next one? And it goes, oh, Osama bin Laden. Oh, he got captured.
Right. Right.
But Krugman does the same thing in a way too. He has a way of rephrasing his prior predictions to make him look like he was always right. But it's that kind of same thing, you know. Once you reach a certain level of distinction, a lot of people think, well, you know, the work is done.
See, I think Krugman's not alone in smart people looking silly in the last four years. I think the only New York Times columnist that has come out of the Trump era with their dignity mostly intact is David Brooks, because he was prepared. He had the intestinal fortitude to go, you know what? I'm not going to chase clicks. I'm going to write quality columns that actually inform and support the people reading them. And I'm not mm-hmm. going to worry about my click counts. Now, maybe he either was like, well, if I lose this job, I'll get another job. Or he's one of the sane conservatives at the New York Times. So he thought he was fairly insulated. But that's a risk, right? When your view counts decrease, you become less valuable to a predominantly online publication. Mm-hmm. And I really give him credit for that, because he's, you know, mostly been writing about stuff from like the Heterodox Academy and reaching across the aisle and, you know, really, really basic moral reasoning and moral thinking kind of things, which of course is not sexy in this day and age, right?
He kind of reminds me of, you remember Murphy Brown?
Yes.
I used to love that show. It kind of reminds me of Jim Dial.
You think?
without this, you know, the stodginess, but
right,
more on the remaining on principle, no matter how stormy the deck gets.
Huh, interesting. You said stormy. I'm gonna have to think about that.
That was not intentional, but oh.
like that's the thing, right? These base emotions, they're exciting. And that's why Trump got so much power over people. He didn't get power because I don't care what anybody says. His policies suck. He may have had some victories by accident, but his policies are not good. The only Trump era policies that are decent are the ones that he had nothing to do with, right? They're too low down. Or something like the First Step Act, which is just so overtly brainless and populist, but right. So it was almost impossible for him to screw it up. And he still screwed it up by not going nearly far enough, right? The First Step Act is the equivalent of God resting after just creating light and dark and nothing else, right? Like, well, that's great. You got a bunch of light to shine on stuff that ain't there. And so, I mean, people say, oh, I like some of his policies because they're covering up, they're justifying after the fact that things like the Muslim ban made them feel safer, even though it doesn't actually make them safer. It was a nod to barbarians at the gate thinking, and they don't want to admit that some people do. Some people just have no guilt about singling out millions of people for the actions of a few. Hate to break it to people like that. If that standard was applied to white Christians, y'all would be fucked. Okay.
Yeah. But hello, Crusades.
Yeah. The wall, the Muslim ban, all that stuff. Most people are cowards. I will go so far as to say that. It's not their fault. Bravery is hard. But cowards like policies that keep people out. On some inner level, though, I think people recognize that cowardice within them, and that makes them feel guilty. And then it starts that process of trying to outrun the cycle of cowardice and guilt, because let's face it, that pre-existing cowardice is exactly what's preventing them from addressing their guilt, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I sort of want to close, because a lot of people are probably feeling guilty and or angry because they're trying to outrun guilt themselves listening to this podcast. A lot of very smart people spend a lot of time outrunning guilt because people confuse smart and omnipotent. The smartest guy in the room doesn't have to define themselves by being the smartest guy in the room, right? Guy being a gender neutral term. So what are some ways that we can give people to either feel less guilty or to face that guilt? Because eventually you have to. Eventually you have to look that guilt square in the face and ask, why do I feel this way?
Yes, because here's the thing. You can have perfectly, and here I'm not talking about whether your emotions are valid or not.
Right.
I'm talking about the content. You can have perfectly valid guilt and perfectly invalid guilt.
Right.
What I call earned guilt and unearned guilt. Earned guilt is obviously guilt. You're feeling guilty because you know you have actually done something about which you feel guilty. And when you have examined the contents of the guilt and the situation, you can objectively point to something and say, this is something that I did that was wrong, or, you know, or it caused harm to someone, intentional or not. That is the content of the situation. Whereas an unearned guilt is, you know, you have guilt by association, you have guilt in which you had nothing to do. My favorite example of that is, of course, the notion of original sin.
Yeah.
that is unearned guilt. You had nothing to do with that. But you also have to be careful, because unearned guilt, it's easy to fall for, because it usually comes from an emotional argument.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great way to manipulate someone. If someone wants you to do something, and this is something that mothers have done.
Yeah.
Because, and I understand it, you know, when you have an unruly child, such as I was, and you have all of the pressures, sometimes you crack, sometimes you reach sure. for that emotional trigger, because you need to get the hellion in line, and you need to get him or her to calm down enough so that you can actually do something or talk about it.
Right.
So you reach for the guilt trigger. This is usually after the middle name has failed.
Yeah. All three names
are in trouble. But if your child is too, if they're far beyond that, usually that's when the guilt trip. That's when the mother starts packing their bags, because we're going on a guilt trip.
Yeah. And okay, let's be fair. At a certain point of child development, that's really the only thing that motivates a kid, is your parents are disappointed in you. Like, that, there's no way around that. That is the reality mm-hmm. of early life. The other structures have not formed yet.
Yeah. That's really, at that point, that is the only thing your parents have to keep you in line, or to even get you to stop.
Yeah. Well, that is what the trade-off is supposed to be at that age, right? Mm-hmm. That's how the brain works.
And the problem with us, the problem with humans, I know that people talk about how we are biological machines, you know, our brains are biological computers, where we were as tidy.
Exactly.
Because unfortunately, while that is very effective, you know, during the very, very early years, it also is emotionally resonant. That those experiences that we have resonate with us for the rest of our lives, in greater or smaller degree. You know, it varies by the person because of their emotional makeup. Because again, we are not really, we are tabula rasa in some ways, but we also do have, when we are born, we have a personality.
Yeah.
There are traits of it that we can change, of course, but it's not like we're perfect little automatons that people just put stuff in. We are born with our personalities.
Yeah.
And that may exacerbate, you know, how susceptible we are to being guilted, etc. I am not a biological determinist. I acknowledge that these things exist. We can do things about it. We can, once we become aware of this, we can take measures to find a way to make them less effective on us. Yeah. So you need to watch out for this unearned guilt rearing its head. And yes, we can see it in cases such as the family trying to tell you, you know, come over, come to Thanksgiving, I haven't seen you in almost a year, this year has been awful, etc. And yeah, it's someone who wants to see you, who wants the company, who wants that feeling of the world as it used to be, mm-hmm. To have some level of comfort. That is something that you can't deny. Everyone is feeling to one,
right.
You know, in one way or another. I certainly do miss being able to take trips. This year was my 16th anniversary with my husband, and mm-hmm. we were planning. He had never gone to Disney World, so I wanted. I had saved up a whole week of work. I had saved up the money so we could go and stay in the park and do all of that. Because we're planning our 20th, we're planning France, but you know,
nice.
He's never been to Disney World, and that I cannot let that happen as a Disney.
Yeah. You got to, as an aside, you got to stay at Animal Kingdom Lodge.
Oh gosh.
You got
it. The last time I stayed, it was for the Ford Wilderness.
Oh, okay. If you liked Fort Wilderness, like, Animal Kingdom is like Fort Wilderness with actual animals and much better food.
Oh God. We're going to go that, but, actually, Fort Wilderness. It's kind of funny. When the last time I went there with my mother and my dad, my mother was still alive, and we decided to, you know, get the cabin in the woods, etc. So we were walking to get to the bus, and it was one of those, you know, 3 second rain showers that, that happened. In 3 seconds, the skies opened and we were soaked. My mom almost got pneumonia.
Oh, those Florida rainstorms, there's nothing like them.
No, it isn't. But I can understand. I mean, I can understand all of that. I mean, right now I'm thinking, you know, it's at the end of October because, you know, we met on Halloween. So, and Halloween is our favorite time of the year.
Oh my God. Halloween at Disney is so good too. Go to Animal Kingdom at Halloween. It's the best, and it's cheap too because it's kind of hurricane season.
Yeah, and that's when they do the that's when they switch over into the night before Christmas Halloween mixture. And
yeah. Oh, Halloween! They grow Mickey pumpkins. It's so cool.
It's so cool, but yeah. So I'm looking at that. I'm going and I looked at it and I went, well, I have two options. I can be in total and absolute denial and still try to make this work. I can be miserable about it, or I can go, or I can think, well, you know, I can't, we can't do this in any good conscience because it'll put everybody's lives at risk. I am going to wait for a year so that we actually have a 17th anniversary.
Yeah.
Instead of facing the possibility that one of us or both of us might be gone because, you know, we don't, there are, that is one of those things about this disease that this virus that it leaves very, it is, even if you're completely healthy, I know perfectly healthy people who have cardiac damage and lung damage, who didn't have underlying conditions. So it's not like, oh, well, it's, you know, it's a bad flu. If it were a bad flu, okay, who cares? But it isn't.
And that's the thing I'm really struggling with. I mean, it's interesting that you talk about it as earned guilt versus unearned guilt. We come at this the same way, but I just use different words for it.
Yeah.
I separate using, there's guilt, which is bad. There's regret, which is some learning, some just beating yourself up. And then there's accountability. Mm-hmm. And accountability is, you know, I summarize it as it's not my fault, but it is my responsibility, right? And the truth is that anytime you can turn guilt or regret into accountability, that means you're thinking critically, that means you're learning, right? Because guilt is useless. There is nothing, guilt is a starting point, right? Guilt is like fear or anger or sadness. It's only useful if you can stop and go, okay, why am I feeling this way? Because if you can't do that, then it controls you and you do a lot of things that you end up feeling more guilty about. And this is the spiral addicts get into. They constantly try to outrun the bad feelings because they feel like they have no control over anything. Right. It's just stuff that keeps happening to them and oh, poor them and so on and so forth.
Right.
So, I mean, accountability is tough. Sorry, go ahead.
And I just thought of something as the quandary of how do you say, what do you say to yourself and to your family in cases such as this? Well, and I think this is very applicable. There is something that you can say, and it is, as a child to your parent, you taught me that sometimes you have to make decisions that upset people, that are, that leave you in a not ideal circumstance, but you need to do them because it is the right thing to do. And in the long term, this is, it is the right decision. It is the proper decision to make for everyone involved, and at least for your part. And the reason why I am not coming this year is because I am making this decision right now, because I want to be able to see you after Thanksgiving. I want to be able to see you after the end of the year. if I come, because we don't have rapid testing, we don't have the things that tells that right now can tell us this person is safe to this person is safe to visit you.
Even rapid testing, you can test positive. So you can test negative and then 3 hours later test positive.
Yeah, because we don't know that. Right now, the right thing to do is to be patient, is to find maybe a different way of getting together, because we have the internet, which a lot of people in countries that have been hit by this may not have.
Yeah. See, that's
something you can be thankful for.
That's the trouble with the situation in Canada right now, as opposed to, I mean, the US is out of control. Everyone in the US can essentially make that argument and have it stick. In Canada, in a lot of places, it is not quite that bad as yet. The problem is that we are just on the precipice of it getting that bad. Our hospitals are okay now, but if it gets any worse, they won't be. Hospital staff are coping mostly, but you know, it's not like the burnout that's going on in the US. But again, if it gets any worse, it's going to be like the way it was back in like March and April. But you know, so some people's families will not accept that here just because they don't see it everywhere the way the US does. And I know lockdowns are unpopular, but I really think that the reason that lockdowns work is not because they actually prevent the spread of disease themselves. It creates a mindset that people can see something happening, and so they take it more seriously, right?
Oh, yeah.
I think the way the lockdowns were managed, and I know this is off topic, but people may be interested in this. I think the way the lockdowns were managed was wrong. I could get into this more on a future podcast, but I really think it had to be like, okay, when you have a case positivity rate of this, then this happens. Or if you have so many active cases, this happens. You know, you have 500 active cases. Okay, this gets restricted. You get 1,000 active cases, or, you know, 500, depending on the population of your area. Well, then this happens. So people know, you know, you hit that 1,000 case threshold, you go into lockdown. You knew the rules. The way it is now, it's all kind of retroactive and okay, we're going to do it now. And there seems to be no rhyme or reason to it. And that's, I think, why people feel like it's so horribly unfair. Instead of, okay, guys, these are the rules. These are the benchmarks where stuff will kick in. People feel like that's a bit more fair when they're given the rules in advance. And I think that the lack of that has been the real problem in trying to maintain their discretionary decision-making. Politicians actually lost a lot of it because people no longer trust their discretionary decision-making. And again, that's, you know, the flip side of feeling guilty is feeling like something's unfair. I will say to people that you may break down. People are not supposed to say this, but I'm going to say real truth. A lot of people are breaking down and a lot of people are giving into the guilt. And there is a period where you do that. And this is the one thing that is holding me back right now with this situation for my mother, that I know in the short term, after I see her, I will feel more guilty because I know I gave in, right? I will know in my heart I didn't do it because I thought it was the quote unquote right thing to do. And on the one hand, this is me trying not to make the past mistakes I made. This is my attempt to make a whole new different set of mistakes, right? And eventually, hopefully, find a middle ground, because I have a tendency to just go, nope, rules, rational, practical. That's the way it's going. And just you may notice I'm fairly decisive about things. That has a social cost that has hurt me in the past. And I don't, you know, it has been hard. I don't know how many years I have left with my mother. I know I'm not going to give it to her. She may give it to me. And that actually makes the whole thing much harder. And then I start thinking, okay, it wouldn't be just me. It'd be my husband. It'd be anybody I accidentally came in contact with. See, the more I think about this, the more I talk about this, the more I realize this is a pretty bad idea.
And that's a whole point of it too. You need, sometimes when you're in quandary, you need a sounding board. Even if they don't say a thing, sometimes just speaking through the arguments yourself helps you with clarity.
That's not it for me, because I'm an introvert. For me, it's that now that I've said it out loud, I feel guilty for being this dumb. I knew I was dumb. And now, you know, I'm admitting I'm being dumb, and I'm being dumb for good reasons, but let's face it, I'm being dumb. And considering I do a podcast where people expect me to be a smart person, it's like, this is in complete conflict with my professional image. What the F am I doing? Right? I started this off saying, I know it's a bad idea. I know I'm being driven by guilt. The more I talk about it, the more like the guilt of admitting it in public is just overriding the private guilt. It's still guilt. And I'm incredibly aware of it. In this case, perhaps I just talking about it in public, I'm pushing myself towards the guilt I think is going to give me the justification to make the better decision, which, okay, is completely emotional. You shouldn't need a justification to make a good decision. The truth is, however, so often in life, the most correct decision is often the most unpopular one. And that's something we're going to have to explore too. Why is that? Why is that correct decision the most unpopular one?
Then the hardest to make.
Oh no, it's an easy decision to make. Selling the decision is hard. Convincing other people that it's the right decision, because it's usually it's because it's change, and people don't like change. People like something that's very simple and mostly maintains the status quo, right?
Right.
So I'm going to have to start writing.
Sense of stability.
Yeah, I'm going to have to start writing things down on post-it notes and sticking it to my screen from now on. I'll just use paper from now on, because I think that's selling a decision, dealing with the fact that when you engage in critical thinking, you tend to be extremely unpopular in an era where popularity is essentially life right now. I hate that. I hate.
It's like we're in high school again.
It's worse. It's worse than that. It's worse because, you know, high school is eventually going to end. it's only 5 years, seven. For some people I know, but the unpopularity of the right decision is something that needs to be unpacked, but that'll be something for another week. For this week, we hope you enjoyed the journey through my familial guilt. I'm normally not this open, but in this case, it was just so.
Well, I got to see critical thinking in action.
Yeah, but I mean, it was just so on topic that I will debase myself and embarrass myself for the greater good, right? This has been the Broken Clock Podcast. I'm Leanna Kirsner with Mouse Mary, just on the FU Network. Become a patron. Financially reward my shame. funetwork.tv. We're still working on merchandise and all that stuff. We're still working away on the store. COVID's just made everything so weird. But as usual, Mouse, we're wrapping up, so you have the final word.
So I have a quote from Seneca that I think is very apropos regarding guilt and peer group pressure. And it says, "For it is dangerous to attach oneself to the crowd in front, and so long as each one of us is more willing to trust another than to judge for himself, we never show any judgment in the matter of living, but always blind trust. And the mistake that has been passed on from hand to hand finally involves us and works our destruction."
That's spot on and just makes me feel more guilty for being dumb.